On Tech News Today, Apple revealed a ton of information about its Apple Watch, and it's complicated. Plus, Apple was found guilty of violating patents for pagers. And Nielsen plans to measure streaming internet TV. Stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, November 19th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. And by Citrix GoToAssist. GoToAssist offers a secure cloud-based solution for IT and customer support professionals to provide live and unattended remote support to their employees and customers working from any computer or mobile device. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToAssist.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. And Anthony Nielsen, how are you loving that Skype today?
We had a rough start, but I think everything's going to do well moving forward, so...
Just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean that Skype isn't out to get me. That's my fundamental belief here. That there's always a Skype thing going on, but I guess if it was easy, anybody could do it. Bloomberg View technology columnist Katie Benner is our co-anchor today. Welcome to you, Katie Benner.
Hi, great to see you.
Great to have you on again. You've been so busy. It's been so hard to pin you down into one place to get you on the show, and I appreciate you coming on the show today to be our co-anchor. This is going to be an awesome show. We got tons of news, so why don't we jump right into it? Apple released yesterday a bundle of information for developers wanting to support the Apple Watch. In the process, they revealed a lot more information about the product and how it's going to work. Buster Hine writes for Cultimac and joins us now. Hey, Buster.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us. Now, Apple Watches come in two sizes. We knew that already, but what we learned from the Watch Kit is that this involves two different screen resolutions. Is this going to be a pain in the butt for developers? You said I could say butt, John, so.
I think, you know, developers will have to develop for two different sizes. The larger Apple Watch will have more pixels. Apple says they're both Retina, but they've also made the UI so it scales pretty well for other apps. So people are thinking that, you know, it could be a hint that other form factors could come pretty quickly as well.
I'm curious about the different kinds of notifications with this new watch. What are glances, for example?
Glances, they're just the quick view where you don't interact with the watch or touch it at all. Apple has glances and notifications so that you can just get quick information and then get on with your life and not have to pull out your iPhone to see what the temperature is or, you know, a new text message or email that you got.
That sounds to me like a very Apple-esque concept. Basically, they were bragging when they rolled this thing out about glanceability and glanceable content. And what that means to them is you developers, if you're going to use this kind of notification, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't scroll, you can't have interaction, then people can't touch it. It's there, that's it, it's glanceable, that's how we do it. And of course, they have other ways to do that, but they really want to push this concept of like, oh, look, information, and then you don't do anything with it. Kind of an interesting concept. Now, how about the different kinds of layouts? For example, what are hierarchical and what are page-based layouts? What's the difference between those two?
So you think like a hierarchical layout, that would be kind of like the email app that you have where, you know, you have a list of different panes of information, whereas the page view would be more like your weather app where you have all of the, you know, stats or information that you want that you can scroll through on a single page. Right now, really, the Watch Kit is designed just to be really a window to your iPhone, like a separate one where most of the processing and everything happens on your iPhone. And that watch is just used to quickly get information from the apps that are running natively on the iPhone.
Now, Apple's trying to get developers to create apps, of course, and even though the native apps won't be possible until next year, they say, will the early work, I mean, essentially, just to be very clear about this, the initial wave of apps will only work exactly the way Android Wear works, which is that a watch app is really a phone app that supports the watch as a peripheral device, and so essentially you're modifying a special phone app. In the future, they promise they'll have native apps that will be installed on the phone, etc. But will the work done on the early version of these apps, the Android Wear style of development, Would that be wasted? Why would developers want to jump into that only to have native apps become supported very soon, presumably sometime next year?
Well, I think at least you can get your information over onto the Apple Watch and you can, you know, get a foothold. I do agree that, you know, it's a bummer that native apps aren't, you know, supported right out of the gate, because you would think that a lot cooler things can be done. But hopefully when they do come out in 2015, a lot of developers with their first wave of apps will have thought of new things that they can do once they have an app embedded on your Apple Watch too.
You know, people are also really interested in the fonts with the Apple Watch, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
It's an homage back to the Macintosh font that looked like ransom notes, San Francisco. And Apple designed it so that it looks good when it's scaled up and scaled down. And it just basically, it's supposed to fit the overall interface and UI of Apple Watch seamlessly, so that when you have these smaller glances, short notifications and long notifications, everything looks perfect, like Apple likes it.
Buster, overall, from all of this information, what jumped out at you as the most interesting or surprising fact that we learned?
Just how dependent Apple Watch will be on your iPhone. It's really not going to be a device where you can just leave your iPhone at home and go with your Apple Watch. You're still going to have, you know, your iPhone in your back pocket or your backpack. And so that was, you know, kind of the biggest shock, I think, is that it's not going to be a fully functional device yet in the first generation.
Buster Hine writes at cultofmac.com, also edits there. And you can follow him on Twitter at BST3R, which is kind of spells Buster, sort of, kind of. Thanks for joining us, Buster Hine.
Thanks.
All right. We got some more Apple news for you in just a minute. But first, I want to talk about Prosper.com, one of our sponsors. There's the old way to borrow money, and none of them are very appealing. You can rack up more credit card debt if you want. You can borrow money from family or friends if you're brave. Or you can get a loan from a bank. That's not that appealing, let's face it. But now there's a new and better way to borrow money, which is Prosper.com. Prosper is an online marketplace that connects people who want to borrow money with people who want to invest. And you can borrow up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days. And it's a fixed rate loan. If you want to check your fixed rate right now, you can do it really easily, and it won't even affect your credit score. So for a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit fans a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Just go to prosper.com/twit, and that's a special site just for the Twit community. Up to $35,000 in 5 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card. Just go to prosper.com/twit. In other Apple news, a federal jury has ordered Apple to pay a Texas company called Mobile Telecommunications Technologies $23.6 million for infringing 5 patents, pager patents. Joining us now by phone is Bloomberg patents reporter Susan Decker. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Now, what would Apple be doing with pager-related patents?
Well, the allegation is that mobile telecommunications patents are actually for the SkyTel network. And if you remember back in the day, SkyTel two-way paging was the thing. And their argument was that the messaging services on the iPad and the iPhone and the iPod are based on that foundational technology, and they wanted some money. And they actually asked for about 10 times as much as the jury gave them. But the jury in Texas did say, well, they're entitled to something.
What was Apple's defense?
Apple said they weren't using the technology. They just said that mobile telecommunications was just overstepping the bounds and trying to claim credit for all sorts of things, including emojis of all things. And they just said, you know what, these ideas weren't new on these particular patents. SkyTel may have been a great company, but these particular patents weren't anything new. And they tried to invalidate the patents, and it didn't work.
And in addition to emojis, I understand that they also, Apple claims that they were trying to enforce a patent on calendar invites. I don't know if that's the concept of a calendar invite or the concept of emojis, or are these specific emojis and specific calendar invites?
No, it was actually how they're sent and stored and transmitted. It wasn't saying that they invented emojis, but just the concept of that technology or the emoji being stored on this system and then being how you store it and how you transmit it. It wasn't, they said, you know, the colon pair thing. They didn't say that they invented that, at least.
Got it. And will SkyTel be suing anybody else?
Well, they have another case against Samsung. That originally They had sued Sprint, Apple, and Samsung, and Sprint, that case, I believe, settled. Samsung and Apple almost went to trial together as co-defendants, which would have been kind of fun.
Wow.
But instead, the Samsung trial is going to start jury selection December 15th, excuse me.
What a strange and bizarre story. I understand they filed all kinds of lawsuits, including BlackBerry and even the United Parcel Service, UPS. Very, very strange. So we'll see how this comes. Of course, this is a pocket change for Apple, but it's weird to be defending against page-related patents from the 90s. Very strange. Susan Decker is at Bloomberg.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at SusanDecker1. Thanks for joining us, Susan.
SUDecker1.
SUDecker, yes, SUDecker1. Thanks.
All right, thanks.
Take care. Well, the TV metrics company Nielsen plans to start measuring subscription video on demand, or SVOD, viewership on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and others starting next month, according to an exclusive by Keech, Hege, and Suzanne Veronica in the Wall Street Journal. The companies don't want to disclose the numbers, but Nielsen says they can figure it out anyway. This would be the first time shows like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black would be measured. Keech Hege joins us now. Welcome to you, Keech.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, did I pronounce your last name right? Is it Hege?
That's close enough.
All right, let's go with that. You wrote that the Netflixes and the Amazon Primes of the world don't want to reveal the numbers. So how is Nielsen planning to measure viewership?
They're going to use audio signatures of shows, which right now that's what they use kind of as a backup for their traditional measurement. And they're going to build out their database of shows and basically listen on televisions for what's streaming there and then match that to their database.
You know, it's interesting. One of the blockbuster things in your story is that it's implied that streaming services really are cannibalizing TV. So I'm wondering how big the effect is and what the implications are there.
Right. So Nielsen basically asked folks before and after they had signed up for these services, you know, how much TV they were watching, and they found a 20% drop after someone has signed up for an SVOD service. There's a smaller drop between the same time for people who had SVOD services in both times, but they also found a 20% drop, you know, between people who did subscribe and who didn't subscribe to SVOD. So it really suggests that the cannibalization that has been so controversial could be quite real. Wow.
Now, media executives don't like the Nielsen numbers at all. Why don't they like them?
Well, I would say the main reason they don't like them is because they're going down for most media executives. The ratings this past third quarter drop have been down 8% sort of across the entire industry, which is really unprecedented. And there's a lot of debate in the industry whether this is, you know, secular or secular, but the drop is so big that everyone has to acknowledge that something major is going on. And the media executives say this is because Nielsen is not measuring a lot of the viewing that we're getting. People who are watching on demand after 7 days, people who are watching on gaming consoles, even people who are watching on mobile devices. And there's some truth to that. Nielsen is still rolling out its capabilities to measure some of that stuff. But what they don't like to talk about is how much of that viewing is going to Netflix and Amazon, because, of course, they get checks from those guys.
Okay, so say this is a secular shift. How do the new Nielsen numbers affect the ability of the streaming companies to negotiate prices for content and get more content onto their sites?
So it will affect those negotiations because right now the streaming companies have the complete upper hand. They know how well shows do on their platforms and nobody else knows, which is, you know, that drives people in the content business totally up a wall. Everyone else gets to know, you know, how other shows perform on other platforms, but not there. So I think this will help content owners in their negotiation because it will just give them more information.
Money2004 in the chat room says that teenagers don't even know what TV is. So clearly the writing's on the wall for the conventional networks who are not big on the internet. Keech Hege is at WSJ.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Keech Hege. That's KEACHHAGEY. Thanks for joining us, Keech.
Thanks for having me.
Google plans to label websites that look good on smartphones and may boost those sites in search engine rankings. Sites can earn a Google mobile-friendly badge if they don't require Adobe Flash, if text can be read without zooming in, if users don't have to scroll to see content, and if links are far enough apart to enable tapping with a fat finger. ComScore says more than one-third of all time spent on the web is done on a mobile device. Katie Benner, is this fair? Is it fair for Google to advantage and favor mobile-ready web pages, especially given that two-thirds of the viewership of websites is not on a mobile device?
Sure. I mean, I think that for consumers, whether it's fair or not, I think it's great for us because there's probably nothing more frustrating than being on a device and trying to find a site that works. And it's a tough slog through a lot of pages. So for consumers, I think this is a great idea. Obviously, developers are going to be up in arms if they're not a favored site. And you can argue that Google is disadvantaging people. But it's also a recognition of this is the world that we live in and where it's going to mobile.
Especially in a lot of markets in around the world, mobile is like really, really dominant. And of course, it's the fastest growing in any segment. Google offers a web page where you can go and enter in your site and it'll tell you how friendly it is and whether it qualifies for the special badge. Well, the Chinese government stopped censoring the web for a few days, but only in a small city called Wuzhen, where China's new cyberspace administration is hosting what they're calling the World Internet Conference, even though all but two of the speakers are Chinese. Outside Wuzhen, the government is actually censoring more sites than usual in a crackdown that's probably related to the conference. What do you think that the Chinese government is trying to accomplish here, Katie? They seem to be asserting leadership, and you know they have good reason to do that in a sense because a huge percentage, I think it's one quarter of the world's internet population, is actually within Chinese borders.
Sure. It's sort of an interesting experiment for China. It's a country that definitely needs to show itself as being friendly to technology. It has a huge internet user base and then also has to do this dance of balancing what happens on the internet with the more restricted freedoms of people within this country. So it feels more to me like a PR move than anything else. Like, well, we are preparing for a day when maybe people will access more information, will have less control. But at the same time, we're going to demonstrate that outside of this tiny experiment, we still have total control. And it's really, really difficult to get information.
To me, it's kind of a microcosm of the entire thing that the Chinese government is trying to accomplish as it emerges from the shadows of Maoism, in the sense that it's trying to be, you know, it's essentially a capitalist country mostly that's controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. They're trying to have it both ways with some authoritarian control and some of the freedoms that build wealth and bring people out of poverty and so on. And this is a perfect microcosm where they have this conference, they open up the internet and make it free in that one little bubble, and while they're clamping down on the rest of the country. It's kind of they're trying to navigate to a future where they have the kind of order and control that they really, really want, but also the economic growth that comes with opening things up. So it's a delicate balance, and they're trying to achieve that balance, but it sure smacks of hypocrisy to me.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Well, Twitter has completed the indexing of every tweet ever tweeted since the service launched in 2006, about 500 billion messages. And you'll eventually be able to access these tweets through a regular, ordinary search on Twitter.com. Right now, you can conduct a search using the new index on the site's advanced search page. The page even lets you search for positive, negative, or question-related tweets as parameters. Meanwhile, Facebook still doesn't enable searches for the content of any post ever. This is great, Katie Benner. I think Twitter is just a fantastic, I think it's biggest value may be Twitter as a search engine.
Yeah, I love this so much. I think that one of the reasons why Twitter is sort of deemed hard to use or difficult is because people wonder, how can I find information in my stream? It's just this scrolling mass history that's really hard to find anything in. So this obviously helps address that problem. But the other thing it does that I find sort of fascinating is it creates it sets up competition with something like Quora. You know, so Quora's mission is to be an index of thought online, you know, all of the world's thoughts, questions, the way that we naturally interact with one another. Quora is supposed to do that. Twitter, on the other hand, we've been doing this naturally since the site launched where, you know, Mike, I'll have questions for you. I'll just throw them out on Twitter. Other people will chime in. And suddenly you have this amazing repository of opinion on Twitter, and we'll be able to search that too. And so it sets up a challenge for a site like Quora.
Nick Bilton, in writing the book Hatching Twitter, which of course is about the history of the founding of Twitter, describes all these scenes that sounds like he was there, you know, talking about the weather and what people were wearing and little things that they did and said. And a lot of this, he says, was based on going back and searching for tweets and finding out what people were tweeting about. And so as a research tool to sort of look at the state of the world or a state of a particular group of people or a single person at any given point, especially if they're heavy Twitter users, it's a fantastic resource. I think this is, and of course, as a big data resource of data, it's already been demonstrated to be fantastic to figure out what the mood of the world is, what people are saying about different things. And so, yeah, this is great, great news. And wasn't it the Smithsonian or I believe it was that grabbed every tweet ever tweeted and sort of put it in the museum somewhere in the basement?
Yeah. And, you know, I fully expect you to use this new tool when you write your expose on Skype. You can
go back and
find all of the information on Twitter.
You'll see these explosions of people saying Skype is down or whatever. You know, yeah, it's right. It's just great for that. Fantastic resource for that. Well, in just a minute, we're going to tell you some new updates. But first, I want to tell you about Citrix GoToAssist. Do you have remote or mobile employees, even employees on the other side of the building? If so, I highly recommend the number one global market leader in remote support, which is Citrix GoToAssist. It enables you to solve support problems fast and, more importantly, solve them securely. Setting it up takes less than a minute, and with GoToAssist remote support, you can provide live and unattended remote support to any computer or mobile device, and you can screen share with employees to diagnose and fix their problems collaboratively. GoToAssist apps even let you do it from your Android phone or tablet or from your iPhone or iPad, so you don't need to be at your desk either. Doesn't matter how many people you have to support, whether it's 1 or 1,000, GoToAssist is the best way to do it. Sign up today for a 30-day free trial, no contract, no credit card. Visit GoToAssist.com and click on the Try It Free button now. We got some email from a TNT fan named Robert. He says, I'm a software developer and college lecturer from the tiny country of Malta, and I've been regularly listening to TNT and Security Now for the last few years, and both shows are entertaining and informative. You keep me company while driving on our hectic roads. I just listened to episode 1138, that was yesterday's episode, where a guest of yours commented on the Europeans' feelings toward Google. Living here, I must say, I don't see the picture he described. Most people here are happy to use Google, Chrome, and Android phones. Keep up the good work. Yes, yes. Google's huge in Europe, especially Google Search, where it has 90% market share. I think sometimes Europe is used as shorthand for the European Union, the sort of organization that's doing some of the things we were talking about. We were talking about the differing legal statuses of search engine results, where in the U.S., four court results have essentially ruled that search engine results are constitutionally protected free speech, whereas numerous rules and court cases in the European Union have ruled that it's very much not protected as speech. And I think the comment, Robert, that you're referring to is when our guest suggested that Europeans see Google as kind of a threat to local industries, that they've been unable to create a European Google and so on. But I think what he was talking about, I can't speak for him exactly, but he was talking about the politicians who spend a lot of time with the companies and industries, and they get a lot of lobbying and so on. And they're probably within the tech sector in Europe, I think there's a sense that the American giants are overly influential and overly powerful, and could be in some cases that Google has been accused of using its monopoly on search engine results to favor its own products and services over those of competitors, including European competitors. So I think that's what he was talking about. I don't think he was referring at all to the general sentiment of the European public, just the European Union, which again has been heavily lobbied on this issue. Well, we've got a few updates for you. The U.S. Senate rejected the USA Freedom Act by a vote of 58 to 42. It needed just two more votes to pass. The bill would have ended mass metadata collection by the NSA and provided more oversight of the agency. It would have also required the NSA to get phone call data with a warrant every time rather than having it all in their possession. One of the reasons it didn't pass is that it was watered down from the House version, so some proponents of limiting the NSA withdrew support because it was too lenient. But most opponents who voted against it felt it wasn't lenient enough, and it limited the ability of the NSA to protect the U.S. From terrorists. The Patriot, they even used the ISIS boogeyman. The Patriot Act will expire in June, so new legislation will be required if the NSA is to be allowed to continue to hold on to phone records. So we'll be paying attention to that vote if it happens coming up in June. What do you think about this, Katie? Were you expecting this to pass the USA Freedom Act?
you know, there's been so much concern, I think, over the NSA that people were expecting it to pass. But, you know, the vote broke down really along party lines. And so I think that when we see this issue come up again, it will be interesting to observe what happens, because now Republicans control the Senate. And if it breaks down along party lines again, I mean, what will it take, I guess, for government to take this issue? I'm sure they take it seriously. What will it take for government to reflect the concerns of constituents on the ground about what's going on with the NSA? And if the Senate can't pass a bill, and if Congress doesn't produce anything, then does it mean that there has to be consumer pressure on companies, and does there have to be a more concerted voter effort to try to get something done?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And I think Republicans were emboldened by the recent election. But either way, just two votes shy and off it goes. You know, I really thought it had a good chance of passing, and I was a little surprised that it didn't. But there it is. They didn't pass it. Well, PayPal unveiled yesterday an app for buying things with a Pebble smartwatch. The app will also show PayPal notifications. I guess this is the last gasp before the Apple Pay supporting Apple Watch hits the market sometime next year. Katie Benner, what do you think, generally speaking, of the Pebble's prospects for surviving the tsunami of smartwatches? I mean, they were so early and they have so many happy customers, but there's so many watches coming out, especially the Apple Watch. Do you think they have a chance of maintaining a viable business?
Yeah, I think it's tough for Pebble. They have a lot of competitors now, and I think, you know, they have a lot of competitors, and I don't know that they make the best product. What's interesting for PayPal is it almost feels like they're using Pebble as a lab. Like, how can we get mobile payments on a device like this correct? Because unlike Apple and Apple Pay, PayPal can work with lots of different partners. So maybe they would work with Pebble, try to get it right, and then also try to work with a lot of other hardware partners.
I also can't think off the top of my head of retailers that support PayPal. I'm sure there are a lot of them out there, but I just, you know, the idea, of course, you walk in with your watch and you pay for stuff with your watch, but I don't know who supports PayPal. Online, of course, there are lots and lots of websites that support PayPal, but in retail contexts, I'm not so sure about that.
It's hard. PayPal's, that has been a really big initiative for them. And even though it's slowly getting off the ground, like they're trying to work with small businesses and give small business loans or a loan-like program and try to get more small businesses to accept PayPal. Again, you're totally correct. It's not very well publicized, and nobody could probably really name five businesses in their town that accept PayPal.
Well, in other retail-oriented news, Starbucks started offering wireless charging in 200 cafes yesterday. The chargers will be embedded into tables and bars. The rollout is being conducted in partnership with AT&T. As with so many new things, shops in the San Francisco Bay Area will be first to get the chargers, with other parts of the U.S. getting them later. Starbucks will use the Power Matters Alliance standard, which is also supported by Google. And Katie Benner, this is something they're trying to finesse the multiple standard problem with these. Apparently, they have these rings that go around your unsupported phone that can enable them to be charged with these wireless devices. I guess you borrow them or you buy them or something like that. I'm not really sure lots and lots of people are going to use this. The other thing that's curious about this, Katie, is that Starbucks has been moving away from AT&T. AT&T currently provides, currently provides some of the Wi-Fi connectivity in Starbucks stores, and pretty soon it'll all be Google, and yet here they're still partnering with AT&T over or something like this.
Right. I mean, it locks in their partnership with AT&T, which may, as you mentioned, might not really be great for them in the future. And it's also a very, I'll be curious to see how many people actually use it and how much of this just feels like a really good, I wouldn't say a PR move, but just sort of a way for Starbucks to assert that it's the place where people want to go and work and be and spend time. Versus, you know, whether or not the wireless charging will really take off in this format.
Yeah, it definitely remains to be seen. I don't really see it either. You really need lots of time to charge a phone with, especially with these wireless chargers, which are less efficient than plugging them in.
Yeah.
Well, our TNT fan of the day is Chris West on Google+, who posted this picture. Now, let's take a look at this. The display in the middle is a 39-inch 4K monitor. And the four monitors around it are each 24-inch displays. He probably gets a tan every day that he uses this. It's just a lot of pixels pointed at his face. That's just astonishing. Wow. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it. That is the tech news today. Katie Benner, how are you loving your new job? You're kicking butt over there. It's really great. Awesome to see you writing all these great columns.
It is great. It's super fun. I'm in San Francisco. My editors are all in New York. So we're, for better or worse, I'm a remote office, but I get to travel a lot and I work with great people. So I love it.
You know, it's better to be in the remote office without adult supervision. It's awesome. So
I didn't say it.
I said it. You didn't say it. Bloomberg View is where you can find Katie Benner. Thanks for joining us as our co-anchor today.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Feedly. If you don't use Feedly, you should try that too. That's really awesome. You can choose many ways to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. Subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. And please, we want to hear from you. Send us email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. Don't miss our evening newscast Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.